Hi, I'm Astrid, and I'm definitely an alcoholic.
Hi, Astrid. We love you, Astrid. Lots and lots and lots. Oh, lunches.
That's the first time I ever got that response. It's very, very cool, and it's really an honor to be here. And I don't even know who to begin to thank because so many people put this on, but thank you, everybody, because it takes a lot to pull something like this off and tie a big red bow in the middle of Fresno. Yeah. And I'm just so moved. I've never been to a young people's AA this big. I'm not around this many young people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm floored, and I'm shocked, and I'm impressed, and I'm amazed. I'm really amazed because I know that statistically, they say 2% ever get a 5-year cake. And so I was watching as that countdown was going down and down and down, and I saw the 5-year and the 4 and the 3, and of course, the 2-year and the 1-year were the largest. And like this gentleman said, where are all those people that he came in with? And, you know, I saw somebody recently take a cake, and she took a cake for 23 years. Her name's Shelley down in L.A., and she said in her New York Jewish accent, she said, I'm closer to a drink this year than ever before. There's nobody left here that I came in with 23 years. They're all gone. And it really scared me. Like, I felt something at that moment when she said that. You know, the safety zone appears to be in those early years, and then I don't know what happens, you know. I'm coming up on 9 years. I haven't gone that far down the road, but hopefully we all can start to practice the message of depth and weight, and we can incorporate the steps into our lives, and we don't have to be one of those casualties or one of those statistics. Alcoholics Anonymous is evolving. The message is evolving. And the disease is also evolving. And like the gentleman here said, you know, in the 12 and 12, it talks about some of those that were scarcely alcoholics and the bottom had to be raised, you know, the young people. But clearly you can see that our society is full of broken, harmed, damaged children that are running around the streets like maniacs trying to quiet a disturbance in their mind and fix something internally and trying every substance known to man. And it's very, very common to see youngsters hit big, big bottoms that other alcoholics didn't hit in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. I think that the public in general has more of a substance abuse problem. You know, I'm curious. I'd love to ask a question. I'd love to see from the audience how many people in here were raised by only one. I want to get to one and two. One parent that was an alcoholic. Shit, that is just unbelievable. And then how many people, both your parents, are alcoholics and dope fiends? See, it's so generational, and it continues to evolve. And in the big book, it talks about the main part of the disease actually centering in the alcoholic's mind rather than their body. And I've seen old timers sometimes get on their muscle about keeping AA to alcohol. But you see, this generation, they've done everything. And there's no way that there's just a real bottle-hiding alcoholic left. And so the message has to evolve, and Alcoholics Anonymous has to evolve. And I'm not here to water down the message. And I'm not here to dilute AA, and I'm not here to lift my leg and piss on its tree. I'm just here to stick with the facts. And the big book says I need to be armed with the facts. And if I'm armed with the facts, then I'm going to know how to treat my disease. So I, like everybody in here growing up, had these ideas that I was going to someday be a wife or a husband, you know, go to college, white picket fence, have all these aspirations and visions. But very early on in my childhood, something else happened. And, you know, I don't know why each person's an alcoholic. It's very hard to determine. But we all cross over the invisible line at some point. And I do believe that some of it is environmental. Neuroscientists now will tell us that
the potential for some people to be alcoholic is greater when you come from an alcoholic family. But that still doesn't mean that you cross over the invisible line and become an alcoholic. So I need to look at that, and I need to see that, did I come from a pain relief seeking environment where I suffered so much as a child, maybe neglect or hurt or harm, and I felt so sick inwardly, maybe I was yelled at and I wasn't treated well and I wasn't nurtured, and so at an early age I was going to seek some type of pain relief substance. And what happens is children go to, these days, oh, video games and drugs and shopping and him and her and Facebook and chocolate and crack and speed and meth and you name it, pick your poison. And what a neuroscientist will tell you these days is that at first we did this thing out of a choice. We did it out of choice because we felt good and it made us feel good. And then we repetitively did it long enough that we crossed over the invisible line and an obsession of the mind took over, and now we became robots. We became sheeple for the substance. And for us, it happens to be drugs and alcohol. And this destroyed our lives. And then what neuroscientists will tell us is that some people have the potential, and it's much greater because they came from one or both parents that were alcoholic. And so we only needed to drink every single night for one summer, and we crossed over the invisible line. Whereas Joe Blow down the street had no parents that were alcoholic, a whole lineage of non-alcoholics. He drank every night throughout the summer and got up in September and went to school every night and did his homework and looked at you and called you an effing loser. Yeah, fuck Joe. So I need to be armed with the facts. And I didn't sign up for that, and I didn't think that I was going to throw my life away, and I didn't think that that's what was going to happen to me. But that is what happened to me. And, you know, for the longest time, I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't know what was wrong with me. Why am I so restless, irritable, discontent? I have problems. I can't solve them. My mind doesn't think about my problems. It obsesses on them. And then I go and I find some type of substance, or I take some kind of detour so that I can get away from me. And I became my worst enemy as a child. And then I take this into my adulthood, and there's huge social consequences to my behavior. I don't get along with people. I get fired. I get yelled at. I get in arguments. I like you one minute. I hate you the next. I have a boyfriend one minute. I'm in love. The next minute I can't stand him. I'm up on stalking charges. And my life is a train wreck. You know, and I don't know what's wrong with me because self can't reveal self to self. And the disease is designed not to see itself. So I just keep thinking, if I could just do a geographical, if I could just get the right guy, maybe if I could get some implants and get some bigger tits, if only I had some money, maybe if I could get discovered and I could become famous, if I could become famous, maybe that would change it. And I go like an insane woman out into this third dimensional society, and I search and I search and I search for the answer that's going to treat my untreated alcoholism, that's going to fix me. But you see, I didn't know that it's an inside job. And I didn't know that everywhere I go, there I am. And I didn't know that there's not enough money to treat this disease. There isn't a dick big enough to fuck this disease. There aren't tits big enough to make me happy. There's nothing out there left in that third dimensional world that's going to fix this. There's only one that has all power, and that one is God, and may we find him now. But you see, I'm so far, Jesus criminy, it's loud in here. I'm so far from that because I have a choice, and I have a choice every minute of every day to do my will and to do what I want to do, or to do the steps as they're laid out. But you see, if the message of Alcoholics Anonymous isn't presented to me, then I don't know what I'm doing. And you know, what's unfortunate is that so often we come into AA and the message that's being presented is what it was like, what it was like, what it was like, what it was like, and what it was like. And you feel like blowing your brains out halfway through the meeting. And then you say to yourself, I hate AA and I never want to come back here again. And what's happened is the message has gotten watered down. And so often I see that you can only get as healthy as the healthiest person in your home group. So hopefully you pick a home group where there's some healthy people. I thank God for my home group, Primetime, down in Los Angeles. We're at Beverly Glen and Ventura Boulevard on a Saturday night. We're not a dog and pony show. There's not a whole lot of Rolls Royce, tits, nails, hair, all that shit. But what we do have is a message of depth and weight. And my home group is not the be-all, end-all, but I hang out with people that are trying to practice the principles in all of their affairs, that are taking Alcoholics Anonymous seriously. This isn't a place to come and win friends and influence people. This isn't a place to get laid. Everybody in here is so sick they have a gown that's open in the back with tampon strings and testicles hanging out. And if you think that Alcoholics Anonymous is a place to come and get laid, it's like going to a junkyard looking for a Rolls Royce. You're not going to find it. I take it really seriously. And this is the place where I come and I learn about what's wrong with me so I can take that information out into the world and apply it out there. I'm safe in here because everybody in here knows we all come from the same stuff. We broke out in handcuffs, you know, we peed on the Christmas tree, we climbed in and out of windows, I don't know, sucked enough dick to fill Dodger Stadium, you name it, you know. Yeah, we went down in the blaze of glory. I can tell you all my secrets and you all relate to me, but how am I going to take that out into the world? How am I going to become a productive member of society? How am I going to practice brotherly and harmonious action? So I'll give you a little bit of what I was like. I had 10 years of very dry sobriety, so dry that I could have started a forest fire or spontaneously combusted, because I didn't apply the steps to my life. So like they say around here, the disease is in the corner doing push-ups, and it waits at every man or woman's elbow to resume its destruction. And it waits and it waits and it waits. And why does it wait? It waits because the obsession of the mind for drugs and alcohol never leaves because we crossed over the invisible line. The physical allergy will now never be erased from us. It's a stain that I can't scrub off of my physical body. It's in there. I'm tarnished that way. And I don't want to ever get self-deceived and come to the thought that maybe 10 years later I can do some controlled drinking, because off's going to come the carpet slippers and I'm going to start carpet tweaking. And that's not who I want to be after 10, 15, 20 years of sobriety. So I'm sober for 10 years, so dry I can start a forest fire, and I get into a real bad relationship, and me and this guy start fighting. By the way, statistically, finance and romance, that is one of those true statements in here. Not all of them are true. Some of the statements around here are just ridiculous, like 90 meetings in 90 days. Who the hell ever said that? 90 meetings is not going to treat your disease. 90 lattes is not going to treat your disease. 90 anything is not going to treat your disease. I have to apply spiritual principles to my life. I can go to meetings for the rest of my life and I can stay so sick that all I do is transmit the disease everywhere I go. And that's not who I want to be today. I want to have a psychic change. So what happened was that I picked up drinking and it hit me real hard, real, real fast. And I had a 10-year-old daughter at the time, and she'd never seen me drink, never seen me use drugs, never seen me do anything like that. And within 6 months, I'm in hell. I am drunk around the clock. I'm hungover all the time. I'm yelling. I'm screaming. What the hell's going on around here? Everybody needs to shut up. I have a hangover. I can't deal with anything. And what happens with alcohol is that the American Medical Association has deemed it a depressant. So that's why we wake up every morning and we decide that we are going to blow our effing brains out that day. And usually we don't, and we get through the day, but we swear we're never going to drink again. And somewhere around 5 o'clock, we change our mind. Because the disease changes our mind. Because the disease is really running the show. So every morning I wake up with hangovers. Every morning I hate my life. Every morning I feel sick. And every morning and every day I lead with my wound and I spill my untreated alcoholism out all over the people around me. And I infect them with my toxicity. I'm so pissed off. You know what so-and-so did? And I'm victim-y and I'm blaming. And I'm, like Bill Wilson said, I'm restless, I'm irritable, and I'm discontent. You know, he used words like doomed to an alcoholic death. I love that word. Doomed. I'm doomed. I'm doomed to an alcoholic death. But I can't see it because, like I said, the disease is designed not to see itself. You see, the disease is a parasite and it needs a host. needs something to live off of. And what it does is it lives off of me, and it's the false self. It's the lower nature. It's untreated alcoholism. Whatever you want to call it, you can call it Satan, you can call it Lucifer, you can call it my dark side, my shadow side, my third dimensional man, the monkey mind. I don't give a rat's ass what you call it. It's there. And it uses my words, and it uses my brain, and it uses my story, and it uses my resentments of the past and my fear of the future, and it tells me things about you, and it tells me things about me, and my mind speaks to me with great authority all day long. And it speaks to me with such conviction that I think I know everything. And I'm so damn smart. And I'm busting my whole world apart. And I'm going to drink until the wheels fall off. And my mind is completely shut to any new ideas. And I don't trust you. And you want to hear my story. And my parents were so mean. And my mom spanked me all the time. And my mom's a war survivor. And I never had this. And I didn't make it here. And I've been treated so badly. And, you know, I've come to find that in Alcoholics Anonymous, if I don't get to a place in my life where I realize and have a relationship with the idea that everything that happened to me was given to me through divine order that arrived me at this podium at this moment right here, right now, if I don't have that kind of quality of faith, then I'm a victim. And victims don't make it very long around here because victims blame and don't take any responsibility. So at some point, I must take responsibility for the whole series of events that arrived me here at this podium today. So I get sicker and sicker and sicker and sicker. And eventually my child's falling apart. My house is falling apart. My private practice is falling apart. I am a crazy lunatic. I'm in and out of therapy. And these people come to my house that these parents that are friends at my daughter's school. And they say, hey, we want to take your daughter. Why don't you go to a rehab and we'll take your kid for a while. And I pack my kid up and I give my child away. I give my 10-year-old kid away. And, you know, I saw her maybe 6 or 8 times after that, and then I didn't see her for a long, long time. I packed my house up. I put everything in storage. And first I moved into this junkie's garage, and we were fighting and crazy and the police and restraining orders. And then eventually I just moved out into the street. And in all of 2000 and 2001, 2002, and a good portion of 2003, I lived in the streets with the cart pushers and the panhandlers, drinking vodka and orange soda, smoking all kinds of stuff, sleeping on the side of the freeway, turning tricks, ripping people off. I've been arrested 9 times in and out of Twin Towers. And I've been arrested for drunk in public, open container, possession of a controlled substance, loitering with the intent to prostitute, prostitution, soliciting an officer. It's all the insanity that has, Lee, I like that, soliciting an officer. Hello, officer, I would like to suck your dick for $50. And I break out in handcuffs. You like that? That makes you really happy, right? See, I can say that here and I'm not ashamed, but if I announced that in Starbucks, I'd want to die, right? That's the way we roll. We're anonymous. We're underground. So anyway, my life goes from bad to worse, and I'm coupling drugs with the alcohol, and I start to get into really high states of psychosis where I'm sure that there's a microchip in my eye and that my daughter can see everything that I can see, and she has a remote control and a TV somewhere, and she can turn it on, and she can view what I'm viewing. So I often walk around the street with one hand over my eye, or sometimes I take a bandana and I tie it over my eye, and sometimes I walk over to the 99-cent store on Sepulveda and I buy a 99-cent pair of tweezers, and I go up to strangers and I say, can you do me a favor? There's this thing in my eye. Do you think that you could try to pull this thing out of my eye? And you know, the tragedy about those paranoid delusions is they happened to us. And we have post-traumatic stress disorder. And it's something maybe that's not even talked about enough in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those things were real and they were horrifying. And the things that we paranoid, the delusions and this made-up stories were so unbelievable that still years later, our cells respond. We jump at certain things, certain ideas, certain places trigger us, certain songs, certain words, certain people. And that's the stuff that we need to bring God into our lives for. That's the causes and conditions. That's those are the things way down in the basement that are so painful that we suffer so much that if I don't get a God down in there, if the main part of the disease is in the mind, it's not the conscious mind, it's the subconscious mind. It's where all my stories and my hurts and my harms are. I'm a deeply, deeply injured character. I'm so wounded by this disease. I never thought I would grow up to be a prostitute. I never thought I would give my child away. I never thought I would participate in those kinds of things, lying, cheating, stealing, robbing people. My mom still barely talks to me. My family's horrified and disgusted. You know, warped lives of blameless children. I mean, that's an understatement in the big book, the things that have happened to us. And so what happens is I go on and on and on almost to the bitter end. You know, a couple of real quick stories I'll tell you in the street. Just some like juicy, juicy ones I remember. Yeah, the good ones. I remember like it was February. It really pours rain in California in February. And I was turning tricks in the street and it was pouring. I was soaking wet. And this guy picked me up in a pickup truck and I got in and he just immediately pulled a gun out and stuck it in my face. And he goes, take off your clothes and you're going to suck my... And I just looked at him and I'm like, are you freaking kidding? Like, come on. Why would you... Why do you even need to use a gun? Don't you know I'm walking the street to try to make some money, you fool? And I'm trying to talk him out of it, but there's just no way. And he has this really creepy, scary look in his eyes. You know, I also want to tell you, as a street prostitute, I ran into very, very few really sick, twisted Silence of the Lamb people. They're not all over the place. Statistically, less than 1% of the population in the whole world. Your chances of ever really bumping into somebody that wants to chop your nipples off and poke your eyes out is actually very rare. It's not that common. News for you, number two. They usually aren't alcoholics. They got something else and it ain't alcoholism. But I got in the car with one of those. So now I have this gun in my face and this guy's going to pistol whip me and he's getting all excited because I think he thinks that I'm going to start getting into fear. Well, I've been around way too long to play this game. And I just looked right at him and I said, not only am I not taking my clothes off and not only am I not going to suck your dick, but I'll tell you what, you take that gun and I want you to just look right here. And I could feel my eyes welling with tears because I knew I meant it and I was so ready to die. And I thought, if I'm going to die, let's go now. And I looked at him and I said, I want you to count to three. I get to count one, two, and when I say three, you pull the trigger, look in my eyes, and blow my brains out. And he said to me, you're fucking crazy. Get the hell out of my car. And I never thought that would happen. I didn't think that would get me out of there. And probably about 9 months later, same thing. Got in the car with a guy, pulls a knife. And he's like, take your clothes off. And I just did the same thing. I ripped my whole shirt up, all my ribs and my flat little tits, and I'm all sick in the street. And I'm like, come on, just cut my heart out, cut it out. He's like, whoa, lady, you're freaking nuts. Get out of here. So I have this new ammunition for you women out there in case you ever get into a situation like that. Call the MFers bluff. You know what? Because it's either on, all the way on, and you're going to die anyway, or you can get out with hours and hours of not pleading and screaming. But I had to learn that the hard way. You know, there's another story that's always near and dear to my heart, and it was, again, in February or March, and the rain's pouring, and I used to stay in this burnt-out house off of Sepulveda. And it's one of those houses where half of it caught fire and the other half didn't. And when you go in there, there's that really rotten smell of burnt wood that just you can't get away from it. I mean, it sort of makes you nauseous. And there was this woman way, way in the back in the corner. There was this black girl and she was laying on a sleeping bag and she was really pregnant, like pregnant. And I sat down and I just started to get high with her, smoke out with her. And every once in a while, she'd grab my hand and put it on her stomach, and I could just feel this infant, like, contorting and kicking in there. And I would get the sickest feeling in my stomach, and I would think, one more, and I'm going to leave. And I couldn't leave. And you know, the obsession for the drugs and the alcohol is so much stronger than self-will that it'll trump over my maternal instinct to care for a woman, my herd instinct to nurture somebody else's child, to call an ambulance, to try to help her, to try to talk her out of it. See, I'll go on to the bitter end. This disease is not a joke. I'll sit there and I'll watch somebody die in this disease, and my mind tells me this isn't okay, but the rest of me can't follow. I cannot. There's only one thing more powerful, and that one is God. And I had no God anywhere near me at that point. I mean, God obviously was watching over me, but I didn't feel God's grace then. So I go in and out of jail and in and out of jail and in and out of insanity, and this trick in the street fell in love with me. And he starts following me around, and he's an Indian guy about this big with glasses, little Hindi guy. And he's always showing up at Twin Towers. You know, they yell over the loudspeaker, "How, you have a visitor?" And I'm thinking, who the heck? And there he is behind the glass. I'm in my county blues, and he's, you know, trying to convince me I need to go to rehab. I need to clean it up. I need to get my shit together. And finally, I started going to rehab. I just, you know, I went to one after another. I mean, the amount of money that's been spent in this room alone on rehabs, millions and millions. We could buy the Trump Towers. It's not a joke. It's a very expensive process to get people sober. And interestingly enough, in Bill and Bob's days, they just have a wet one in the back or at somebody's house. We hand our wounded over to somebody else. Somebody else does the dirty deed, and so often we don't even see them anymore. And the price tag, in my opinion, has gotten ridiculous. I mean, some of these, you know, Camp Snoopies, I don't know, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 big books, and you know, statistically only 2% ever get a 5-year cake, and they're loaded next week again, and the spouse is all PO'd because he spent his inheritance or his retirement or his whatever, you know. So I start rehab after rehab after rehab after rehab, and every time I go in, something happens. And what happens is I get stark raving sober, and I get into so much pain that I've given away my daughter that I cannot function. Like, my maternal instinct comes back, and I just feel so sick that I haven't seen her for 3 years. And I weep incessantly, and I miss her so much. I just want to throw up. And she hasn't seen me, and I don't know how to handle the situation, and the people that are raising her, are they going to let her see me, and how am I going to, you know, build some bridge back to safety, and have I completely destroyed my life? And it's a very, very painful process. When you've destroyed everything, it's the good news and the bad news. The bad news is that I'm in so much pain, but the good news is that the pain is the touchstone to all spiritual progress, and it is the admission price, because there's really no place left to go. And if you think there's still some place left to go, man, get your motor running. Get on out there. Go chase that shit, and we'll be here when you're all done and the wheels have fallen off, because it's the last house on the block. It's not the second to last house. If you're in here on a Saturday night, drove all the way to Fresno, Podunk, California, your life depends on it. Your life depends on it. You're here because your life now has meaning, or you wouldn't be here. And I get it. Yeah. Thank you, Alcoholics Anonymous. The fastest growing spiritual movement in the entire world. And still, it's anonymous. It's so elusive to so many people. They don't understand it, because we have stayed anonymous to some degree at the level of press, radio, and film. We are a mystery to the third dimensional world in so many ways. Anyway, getting back to what happened, I started a series of rehabs, and I was in constant pain all the time. And then somebody handed me these tapes by this guy named Bob Anderson, and he was an old-timer from my home group, Primetime, Saturday night. And you know, he broke it down like I'd never heard anybody break it down. And he said that the main part of the illness actually centers in the alcoholic's mind rather than her body, and that I'm the same woman drunk as I am sober if I don't have a psychic change. And what that means is my yesterdays will become my tomorrows, and my past will become my future, because I'm the same without the drink. I put the plug in the jug or the pipe or the cake or the whatever you want. Put the thing away that's making the obsession of the mind, and the thoughts are still racing. And I still hate you the same way. And I still feel sad about my life the same way. And I still flip people off the same way. And I still tell myself scary stories about the future the same way. And I still think the mosquito bite on the side of my neck is lymphoma now and I'm going to die. And I still think all the same things. I fold my clothes the same way. I still listen to the same rock and roll. When I go to a restaurant, I'm going to order the same kind of food. I still like or dislike certain family members the same way. I'm the same person. The book says that the liquor is but a symptom. I have to get down to causes and conditions. It says that lack of power is my dilemma, not lack of liquor. So it's not about the drinking. You see, I really have to look at step one, and there are two very big parts to it. The first half is that I'm powerless over alcohol. Who would come here to Fresno, California on a Saturday night if we weren't powerless over alcohol? So for me to continue to talk about what it was like, what it was like, what it was like, what it was like, and what it was like, and resurrect all my war stories, who cares? Who gives a rat's behind? The more important thing is, what happened to me that I could stay sober for almost 9 years? What happened for me inside that I could be okay with all of those wounds? What happened for me that I could stand up here and talk about being a street whore and have absolutely no emotional connection to it because I'm not that person today? No shame about it at all because I'm not that person today. What happened to me inside that I could be a mom that abandoned her child for 3 years and I have a very, very sound relationship with my kid today? Something happened in between, and it's all of those things that are much more important than the common story. It's the common solution that's really important. And so I start to listen to these tapes and I start to hear that the main part of the disease centers in my mind. And it says, check your own track record. We got to get self-honest. This disease, you're the only one that can diagnose yourself. So I start to look at the thoughts that surf the waves of my brain, and I come to the realization that I'm loaded with untreated alcoholism. 24 hours a day, and you know what? Time isn't going to fix this. I could get 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years sober, and all it is physical sobriety. I'm talking about emotional sobriety. I'm talking about a spiritually sound mind. I'm talking about a God consciousness. I'm talking about a fourth dimension. I'm talking about a new way of life. I'm talking about building a new character with no reference to the old. I'm talking about going inward and doing a wholehearted excavating process, which is not just in the fourth and the fifth step. It's touching any of those spiritual principles that are embodied in the 12 steps, and all of those get me closer to God. So I have to look at that second half of step one, and can I admit and accept to my innermost self that my life is unmanageable, that my thought life is unmanageable, that of me, by me, I cannot think and act to good purpose. Can I just even have a slight belief that maybe, just maybe, every single solitary thought that surfs the waves of my brain might be bullshit. Might. And you know what they say is all you really need is a truly open mind. Abandon the self. So if I have a truly open mind, then I can accept that maybe, I don't know anything anymore. And I look at that second half of step one, and I got to read the Thiebaud papers early on in recovery. I don't know if anybody out there knows who Harry Thiebaud was, but he was a psychiatrist that was on the board of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a psychiatrist that worked with Bill Wilson, and he studied alcoholics in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. He was the psychiatrist that gave the big book to Marty Mann, and she was one of the first 100 people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and definitely one of the first women to stay sober. And he talks about alcoholics all having an infantile ego sober. So often we hear people say things like, We stopped maturing and we stopped growing when we started using. And that's really a fact. It's a psychological fact that most of us have very poor coping skills, very poor communication skills. We don't know how to take the big lumps with the small lumps. And that I don't respond to situations, I react. I nuclear react. You make me mad and I hate you. I love you 1 minute, hate you the next, you know? I turn on you like a rattlesnake. I throw you away like a tissue. And I need to see that this is how I operate. This is who I am. That my thought life is so unmanageable. That my insides are so agitated. That I do have an infantile ego. That I think I should be treated differently. That I think rules are not for me. That I think just because I'm sober, my family should invite me back and I should have all these rights to my daughter and everybody should throw some big party with balloons and stuff because I'm not a hooker anymore and I'm in rehab. And it doesn't go that way. It just does not go that way. You know, some people will never accept us ever, ever, ever after this many years, coming up on 9 years. There are people that don't want anything to do with me at all. And I have to accept that today because I burned that bridge and I hurt them and they got an idea in their head of who I was at that time and it'll never change. And no matter how much I become a new character in Alcoholics Anonymous, their mind and their idea is still stuck on my old character and that's how their glasses look at me and their glasses will never be renewed or restored and I have to accept these things. Just because I'm sober and in application of the steps, it doesn't mean that I get any of those things back. So I look at that second half of step one and I wholeheartedly start to accept that I have an infantile ego, that I'm up against resistance all the time, that I'm on my muscle, that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent, that I'm up 1 minute, down the next, that my whole life is a roller coaster, day in, day out, moment in, moment out. And I don't know how to stay still, and I don't know how to accept things, and I don't know how to be okay in my own skin. You know, I think that often psychiatrists are too quick to jump on the med wagon. First of all, I don't have anything against anybody that has to be on meds. Some people got so chemically warped and imbalanced from their environment early on or from the drugs and alcohol that they really burned entire football fields in their head where neurotransmitter and dopamine and serotonin and neural pathways don't run anymore and they have to set up a whole new formula somewhere else and they need the chemical help in order to do that because they've had such a psychotic break that they now live where the buses don't run. So thank God there is meds for some people, but I think that psychiatry also can jump the gun and they're real quick to just shut the untreated alcoholic up. You know, I feel restless, irritable, and discontent. I just feel like picking my skin all the time and I don't know, I'm just looking at my Facebook and I'm really worried and I think my mom hates me and I don't like my life and I want to die. And it's like, welcome to untreated alcoholism. You know, get a God in your life. Get a sponsor. Get the steps. And so what happens is they pour medication on untreated alcoholism and then sometimes the person gets even more bent or so disconnected that they have a very hard time getting a real relationship with this God that we talk about in this program. So my belief is to give this program a wholehearted try, to give God a try, to allow God into our life, to expel the obsession for anything and everything. And still, if that doesn't work after a year or so, maybe you do need medication. But see, with God, I really do believe that most of these things are possible. And if I allow God to be the manager of my life, then I can knock self out of the way and I don't have to be so self-centered and self-obsessed about my story. So I look at this process of step two, and it says that I have to come to believe that there is a power greater than self that can restore me. So in the book, it says in the prayer, God, I offer myself to thee. It says, my creator, I'm now willing that you should have all of me. It says, any life run on self can hardly be a success. It says, we must be rid of this self or it kills us. It says, selfish and self-centeredness we think is the root of our trouble. It doesn't say alcohol and drugs are the root of our trouble. It says selfishness and self-centeredness. So if I look at those Harry Thiebaud papers and I see that the ego and the self are all scrambled up with the untreated alcoholism and this is who I am, what it's basically saying is I got to get me completely out of the way so I can have a fourth dimensional experience. That can only happen in a surrendered process. And I have to figure out how to get a surrender, how to induce one, how to have a surrender so that I can live in an open state of awareness. Some people call it the pink cloud. Harry Thiebaud called it the positive phase. And it's a state of consciousness that you can have forever. It's not just for the first 90 days of sobriety. We can have this for years and years and years in our recovery if we cultivate it, if we practice the art of surrender, if we practice backing down. It says that we'll have a new employer. It says that I turn everything over to a manager for my life. It says that I allow the creative intelligence to move through me. It says the most valuable thing I have is this God consciousness. Well, it says all those things. Are they just going to be words? Am I just going to stand up here and be a parakeet? Or am I going to roll up my sleeves and do something? Because I could talk about it all day long, but I have to get self-honest about my own life. Did I do it today? Am I doing it right now? Am I bringing God into all of my activities? Am I practicing the principles in all of my affairs? And how the hell do I do this God thing? How do I get some on me? How do I get some in me? This isn't a religion. It's a spiritual plan of action with a spiritual kit of tools. Thank God in AA I can say fuck and God from the same sentence and the same podium, and I'm not going to get crucified on a cross and a crown of thorns. You know, that's the way we roll here. If you don't like it, too bad. So I need a fucking God in my life. I need one. I need a fucking portable God in my life. And I need one 24 hours a day because I'm a fucking lunatic. So it says in step 11 that I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. And that application in step 11 means that I seek through prayer and meditation. So meditation is the quieting, listening for God, and prayer is the petition or the activity of the asking or talking to or rightly relating myself to God. So I start to ask God, can you protect me from my mind? Because the main part of the disease centers in my mind, and my mind's trying to mug me. And I ask God with sincerity, and I ask Him with intention. I say, God, please, could you be with me right now? Because I cannot function in my life today. I can't drive my car. I can't brush my teeth. I can't even go to a meeting. I hate certain people. I don't like traffic. They didn't make my latte right. The people in Starbucks ought to die. They're taking too long up there. Is it a venti or is it a grande? Shut the fuck up and get the coffee. And I'm so restless and so irritable and so discontent that I can't move through my life on a moment by moment basis. I can't do it. And at the end of the day, I think things like, man, I need a drink. I need to blow my brains out. I don't want to live here anymore. So I ask God to be with me, and I take this portable God with me everywhere. And I come to the realization that the only time I can treat my disease is in the present moment. Alcoholism lives in the resentments of the past and the fear of the future. Anytime I'm future surfing, I'm playing God. And it says we had to quit playing God. Self idea doesn't work, the God idea does. Anytime I'm going into the future and telling myself a scary story or an idea about how it's going to be or how it's not going to be, I'm playing God. I have no business going into the future, and I need to build a relationship with this power every moment of every day. I'm willing to grow along spiritual lines. I'm not a saint. I do this in order to save my life, but I'm not perfect at it. I slip and slide all over the place, but it's better than the alternative. And I stand in Starbucks, and when I feel restless, irritable, and discontent, I ask God to be with me. And when somebody's saying something to me that I want to counteract and I want to say something back, I ask God to help me practice the restraint of pen and tongue, and I ask God to help me back down. And when somebody's been mean and cruel to me, I ask God to let me show them courtesy, kindness, justice, and love, because I wouldn't treat a sick friend that way. And I start to have a relationship with the spiritual principles, and the spiritual principles get me into a state of grace where in the end what it looks like for the most part is I don't know anything and I don't need to know anything. I don't know. I don't want to know. I don't want to figure it out. I don't want to have all the answers anymore. I just want to be okay right now. You know, the paparazzi's not coming tonight. There is no red carpet. I'm not going to be discovered, and I'll never fit in a size 2 pair of jeans. It ain't going to happen. I'm so past that in my life. That stuff is not going to bring me happiness. It really is the joy inside and the freedom of living with a power greater than self. And it's all in the steps, as outlined in the big book and the 12 and 12. We have such a little amount of literature, and it's so rich. And yet we don't crack the book open, and we don't pray diligently. I believe in this power, and like it says in page 55 in the big book, it's deep down inside of every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That's where you'll find the great reality. So that means we're wired for God. We're wired for the obsession of the mind, and we're also wired for God. We're wired for spiritual experiences. We're wired for grace. We're wired to intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us. We're wired to be able to let go of things that bothered us yesterday and they don't today. We're wired for surrender. We're wired for compassion. It says that forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. We're wired for forgiveness. I was never able to forgive before. I was like an elephant. You screwed me over in 1972. I resurrect that anger and that resentment like it happened yesterday. And every time I see you, I hate you. I can't really even remember exactly what you did, but you did something and I hate you. And I walk around like that. I walk around like that and I infect my life and I infect the whole world with it. And I don't ever get to change. You know, and I'll end with my daughter. I have a beautiful relationship with her, and she's watched me grow up in AA. And she's not an alcoholic. Yeah, she's 23 years old, and she's a good kid. And we talk about everything, and she knows the whole story and all the horrors, and she feels good about me, and she's proud of me, and that's healed. And only God could have done that. Self wanted to fix it and overmanage it and tell her I'm sorry a million times a day, but that's not what the steps say. When I stayed close to a sponsor and when I stayed close to God, I just allowed my daughter to see me through a demonstration as a woman of God, a woman that's living by the principles embodied in the steps, a woman who walks her talk. I don't run around lying, cheating, and stealing anymore. I just don't do that stuff. If you followed me around with a camcorder, you hacked into my computer, I don't have some big, weird, psycho secrets anymore. I don't live like that because it's too uncomfortable for me. I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm just saying I don't have infectious piles of crap all over the place creating untreated monsters in my basement. I feel comfortable in my skin today, and it was a process, and it continues to be a process. There is no finishing line. All the steps and all the principles can be used at any given time. For someone to say you're not allowed to use prayer and meditation because you're only in step four, this isn't a homework assignment. It's a way of life, for crying out loud. And it has to be lived. And I'm the only one that can live it. Anyway, I think I'm running out of time, and I'm real, real grateful to everybody that put this on. And thank you all so much for coming. And thank you, my home group, for supporting me. Thanks so much for letting me share.